I'm Nancy Murray. I'm an Al-Anon. I'd like to begin by thanking the committee for your gracious hospitality for the beautiful earthenware jug that was in my room when I got here. Believe me, I'm going to treasure that always. It'll have a prominent place in my home. And then I want to tell you that this coming fall, I shall have reaped the benefits of this life-changing program for 20 years. I wish that I could tell you the exact date, but we didn't get chips, and we and I was deranged at the time, so you can forgive me. But I know that it was either October or November of this coming fall. It was in 1977 that the Allatoona Roundup first became a reality, and my husband George and I were fortunate to be a part of your auspicious beginning. As a matter of fact, with 1.5 years of sobriety notched on his belt, he was the Sunday morning speaker at the first Allatoona Roundup. And I sat out there with you, my buttons absolutely popping, as he shared his experience, strength, and hope in his own unique style. It was such a proud moment, one in which I had the awesome awareness and thankful realization that perhaps all that we had been through was preparation leading up to this one special moment in time. A few years later in 1983, George walked in one day and he said, "Guess who's going to be the speaker at the Allatoona Roundup?" And I said, "Who?" And he said, "You." Whoa. Now, up until that time, George was the spokesperson in our family. So I was not entirely comfortable that weekend, I can assure you. In fact, you could say that maybe I was a basket case. But there is one thing that we should learn here, and that's if we don't grasp any other concept. And that is a willingness to participate. As codependents, our lives have been affected by alcoholism and addiction just as dramatically as have the lives of the chemically dependent individuals. And we, too, have a message to carry. Back in January, it was with surprise and humility and gratitude that I received the invitation to speak here this morning, a request extended by our wonderful friend Groves. For Groves' sake, I felt like asking my higher power to give me that one moment in time when I'm more than I thought I could be. Because for better or for worse, this one's for Groves. But after all, I have only one story to tell. And here goes. It all began back in 1937. To save you having to add up, I'll be 58 week after next. I was the youngest of three daughters. My two older sisters are named Faye and Jean, and we were the daughters of Wallace and Winnie Butts. Our dad was a high school football coach, and at that time, he was in Louisville, Kentucky, at Louisville Male High School, even though he was a native Georgian. But it happened that in 1937, they had a terrible flood there, and my mother went back down to Milledgeville, Georgia. And so I was ushered in Milledgeville, and you know, that's not very far from the state asylum. And a few years there, I thought maybe I was going to be ushered out the same place I made my debut, but when I was 6 months old, we moved to Athens, Georgia, and my daddy became the offensive football coach at the University of Georgia. 1 year later, he became the head football coach and athletic director. So I grew up in Athens enjoying all sorts of fairy tale-like activities. We had all these exciting football weekends with celebrities in and out of the doors. I was fortunate enough to have a beautiful mother. She was the most elegant person you've ever seen in your life, very much admired in Athens. I always wanted to be like her, but unfortunately, I'm just a female Wally Butts. And I had a doting father, and I had two older sisters who spoiled me rotten, loved Girl Scouts and dancing and music lessons, just about any advantage you could think of. I went to high school during the days of the sock hops and the high school gym's festoon with the crepe paper. I'm sure a lot of you remember that. rock and roll and Elvis Presley and crushes on all the movie stars. And if you'll remember, all those movies had happy endings, you know, with Mitzi Gaynor going off, you know, it's wonderful. And I thought that that was exactly what was going to be in store for me. The only thing that marred my childhood was that I did contract polio at the age of 3. It was before the days of the salt vaccine. And so I was to undergo many, many years of therapy. Those of you who remember anything at all about Wally Butts know that he was from the old school of coaches. He was very tough, and he was also determined that I would not be crippled, so he sent the team trainer, a wonderful old Swedish fellow by the name of Jonesy, to Warm Springs, and he was taught how to build up my limbs. And he was very successful, so much so that you can only detect a slight limp if I'm very tired. But if you see me hobbling this weekend, it's because my daughters-in-law are making me go to aerobics and I hurt my ankle. So anyway, I admired the movie stars of my day, all the famous singers, and I had crushes on at least half my daddy's football team. Now, in those days, girls, if they were going to downtown Athens shopping, they had to wear dresses and nylons. Can you believe it? Otherwise, we wouldn't have been ladylike enough to suit our mothers. Nice manners were overly emphasized, and so we had to endure endless rounds of teas. I remember those in those coffees, you know, and we had to always mind our P's and Q's. But I decided to make you AA members feel comfortable today and tell you that I wasn't always so ladylike and angelic. And so I'm going to tell you about my first drunk. Now, I want to, this is sort of a confession. It was New Year's Eve and I was 16 years old and I was slated to go to a party and the late show with my longtime high school beau. And I was spending the night with a girlfriend of mine, and she was sort of the ringleader in all sorts of mischievous escapades. And she had a lot more courage and was a lot more free-spirited than I was. So she said, just call him up and tell him you're sick. Said, these great-looking guys from Atlanta are coming over. Boy, they're just dashing and good-looking, and you can have a blind date with the other one, you know. So I did this awful deed and deserved everything that followed. They stood us up, and so to console ourselves on New Year's Eve, we made a big batch of chocolate fudge and put a lot of nuts in it, and we ate every piece of that fudge. And then to my great horror, she said, I'm going to have a drink of my daddy's whiskey. And I said, oh, I mean, you know, we just thought girls who drank were fallen women. I said, you know, you're not going to do that. And she said, yes, I am. And you're a terrible sport and you're no fun. And she kept on until I raised my glass also. And, you know, I remember vaguely, very vaguely, playing follow the leader, shouting and running all over her house, sliding down the banisters, crawling under the sofa. And we were very, very drunk. But that is a vague recollection. What I do remember quite vividly is the details of being held over the commode by her brother, who's now a doctor. He was very disgusted with us. I was so sick, and the room was going, ooh. It was just the worst feeling of my life. And somewhere in all this, the doorbell rang, and apparently I had called my boyfriend, and he showed up to take me to the movie, and he said it was the worst date of his life, that for some unknown reason, everybody scattered from away from us in that theater. Now, I hate for you members of AA to get a resentment this early in my talk, but I just want you to know that that was my first drunk, and it was also my last. Some of us are quicker studies than others. The one thing challenging in my youth was that achievement was very much stressed in our home. My father had a motto, a plaque in his office, and it read, "You must pay the price and never accept anything less than perfection." And I'll tell you, that's a hard motto to live up to. I had two older sisters who were graduated from the University of Georgia at the age of 19 with highest honors. And here came Nancy, majoring in parties, you know, falling along. And, I was never, no matter how much I achieved I was never quite satisfied. I didn't feel like it was enough. But in preparing for this talk, I was looking at an old annual, and I must have done a pretty fair job because I noticed that in the superlatives my senior year, I was selected the girl most likely to succeed, the friendliest, the one with the best personality, and the wittiest at Athens High School, which is now Clark Central. I'm mentioning this now so that you can make a few comparisons as we move along in this story. I went to Georgia, of course. It never occurred to me to do anything else. I had a fantastic time there. I loved to dance. I loved to tell jokes and laugh at yours. Majored in journalism and have a teacher's certificate also. Minored in parties. I was captain of the cheerleaders. And I'd like to mention here that at the homecoming game every year they have Old Cheerleaders Day. And even though I can't walk for 3 weeks afterwards, I go and show off a lot, and it's a lot of fun. At the age of 17, I fell in love for the first time in a most wonderful and awesome and dreadful way. The recipient of so much admiration on my part took note of the fact that I was young and immature and married someone else forthwith, and so it took me a long time to recover from this. When I was about 21, I started looking around, and I was the last rose of summer in my crowd. You know, that old saying, always a bridesmaid, never a bride. Well, it made me nervous because in those days, we went to college to get our man. And if we picked up an education on the side, that was sort of extra. That was kind of nice, but that was not the main purpose. So the first person who came along about then and proposed, I accepted. First of all, because I was on the rebound, and I certainly didn't want anybody to think nobody had ever asked me. We spelled disaster from the first day, but that's another story. But I have no regrets about that marriage, because from it came my two oldest sons, Wallace Butts Weatherby, who was born in 1960, and Harold Berkeley Weatherby II, who was born in 1961. Now, when these little boys were toddlers, all my little fairy tale world crumbled. It just absolutely fell apart because my daddy and Bear Bryant, the late great coach at the University of Alabama, were accused of rigging a ball game in the Saturday Evening Post magazine, which prior to that time had been a family type magazine. But at this particular time, they had adopted a policy of sophisticated muckraking, and they were printing stories without checking the facts. Coach Bryant was already in the process of suing them for a previous article, and as were Marlon Brando and a lot of other people. Along about this time, my father, who had just stepped down as president of all the coaches in the nation in 59, had been made a member of the National Football Rules Committee. He was one of five coaches on that committee, and it was his job to talk to the Southeastern Conference coaches and to explain some of the new rules. And while he was conversing with Coach Bryant one day, explaining a new kicking rule, due to some mix-up in the phone company, a down-on-his-luck insurance agent was cut in on the conversation, and he felt like he was hearing Daddy give away Georgia's secrets to the coach of Alabama. Now, at that time, Alabama was dominating Georgia on the field. So it might be a little bit like today, I'm afraid, but... The University of Alabama stood behind Coach Bryant. The powers who were in office at the University of Georgia felt like it was time for Daddy to resign, and he left without a dime. At that time, they had no pensions for football coaches. I want you to know right now, though, that I wear red and black every fall, and I'll tell you more about that later. Of course, the people who were in positions of power at that time have long since gone. Daddy had just lost a great deal of money in an Orange Grove deal, and so my parents found that they were absolutely destitute. But they went to court. It was a nightmare, 3 terrible weeks in Atlanta with the photographers following us everywhere. But at the end of that time, my father was awarded the largest libel settlement in history, and it really is in the law books if you want to check it out. However, it was many years before that money actually made it to his bank account, and I had been very spoiled as a child. My parents moved in with me, and I was responsible for three uninsured adults and two tiny little boys. I moved them to Atlanta. Because my ex-husband and I had been estranged for a very long time, I guess we just couldn't make it through all that trial, and I found myself divorced. My dad was extremely depressed, and we had to keep a close watch on him at all times. I realized that he wasn't going to make it. And one day I walked in and I really challenged him, and I said, "I'm just so disappointed in you. You have spent a career telling young men that they must pay the price, and you've given up. And I want you to get off your rear end, and I want you to go out and take the job that you've been offered." He had not been able to get a salary job, but he was offered the chance to sell credit life insurance on a commission basis. And he went on to break, I suppose, every record in the nation. In other words, he was phenomenally successful. My dad remained a loyal Bulldog fan and contributed greatly to the athletic program up until the time of his death. And I decided to follow the example of a big man. My George asked him once, "Coach Butts, don't you have a resentment?" And he said, "Oh, no, George, you can't afford to harbor resentments." And doesn't that sound familiar to us in this room? I'm so grateful to say that a year before his death, he was honored at the halftime at the university, honored by all his former players, and now they've built a magnificent building and named it for him. It houses the athletic offices and the weight rooms and so forth there at the university. My father was inducted in the Georgia, the Gator, and the Orange Bowl Halls of Fame, and I had the great good fortune to stand up down there in Miami in front of 5,000 people, along with Joe Garagiola and all these sports figures you gentlemen would know about, and accept that award. I do believe that God's timing is always right. And I'm so glad that my 5 foot, 6.5 inch dad had those last 10 years of his life. And I also want to say that in my opinion, never was there a man so short in stature to stand so tall. But back to yours truly, this is, after all, my story. Now, I found myself nervous and embarrassed about this divorce status. I had flunked marriage, this girl most likely to succeed. And I felt that I had really messed up for all times. So, refusing to attend class reunions, avoiding all the people who had been my friends through the years, just kind of wishing that I might be able to evaporate, I still realize that I'm from a long line of fighters and that I was just going to have to attempt to rebuild my life. I went to work at the Atlanta Times, a now defunct newspaper, and it was along about here that I developed a game plan for my life. Now, you all know that football coaches have game plans. Now, the first thing that I was going to do was find a man, because I was absolutely sure of one thing. I did not want to raise those little boys by myself. But now, I wanted him to be a very homely man. I didn't want him by good looking, because I wanted him to appreciate me and be glad to get me. And he would be a family type man, you know, and we would go to baseball and football and basketball games together and raise these children, and he would love my children and he would worship and adore me. And this was the plan. And then on my part, I was going to love him like nobody loved him, come rain or come shine. Well, you know what they say about the best laid plans of mice and men. June 18, 1815, Napoleon met his Waterloo. July 23rd, 1966, I met George Murray. Now, he flunked my looks criteria 100%. He was so handsome, I wouldn't even look at him. I would just sort of take a sly peek because he had on shorts. And you know how they say that men, some men are eye men. They notice ladies' eyes first. And some are leg men. They sort of notice ladies' legs and other things. Well, I strongly suspect that we women have our preferences, too, and so I'll go down in the record books and tell you I'm sort of a leg woman myself. And when I saw his legs, I had absolutely had it. I felt the earth move under my feet. Now, couple those legs, he was prematurely gray with a head full of silver hair and a tan. And the fact that he proposed 5 hours later, and you have a picture of a card-carrying crazy woman, let me tell you. And you know the most amazing thing about that proposal? It never once occurred to me that he was drunk. I just assumed that he was as fascinated with me as I was with him. Now, we were very mature people, and I can prove it. A week to the day later, he gave me a diamond ring in the Atlanta Stadium, and 5 weeks to the day later, we were married. Why not? After all, we shared enough mutual character defects that we recognized one another as soulmates immediately. I don't have to tell you that a trip down the mighty Amazon on a garbage can lid would have been more peaceful and relaxing. But you know, thanks to you, I no longer regret any of my decisions, nor wish to shut the door on my choice to become Mrs. George Niles Murray, Jr. Now I felt that I could return to the land of the living because I had this good-looking man in tow, and I felt successful again. And football season was coming up, and my daddy rounded up a lot of tickets, and I called all my old friends, and we planned a reunion at the Georgia-South Carolina game in Columbia that year. And I really looked forward to making an impression on all my friends. And, you know, we did leave them with a lasting impression because George had a personal escort by the South Carolina Patrol right out of that stadium. We did have many wonderful times because most of our boys are athletes, and I love sports, thank goodness, and we enjoyed a lot of Little League and Babe Ruth and high school championships. And then there were those special times when we welcomed our own two sons, two new additions, one of whom's with me today. I'm going to ask him to stand briefly. Stan Taylor. This is Michael Taylor Murray. He'll kill me later. He was born in 1967. And then Jack Emerson Murray, who was born in 1969. But you know something amazing? Each time I had one of George's babies, one of his children moved in with us. And we jumped to six children overnight. Now, I'm telling you, this was a sick place, let me assure you. Because very early in our marriage, I became upset with George's drinking. But having taken an inventory, I know now that two very unstable individuals were joined in that marriage. You see, my daddy's trial had left me truly devastated insofar as self-image was concerned. And that divorce just absolutely polished off the rest. And I wanted George Murray to heal all that hurt and make up for all that lack of love in my adult life and all that fear and anxiety. I wanted him just to take care of that. And I think maybe what I really wanted was for him to restore my soul. And I know now that even had he not been alcoholic, that's too tall an order for a mere mortal to fill. But looking at Nancy, I was absolutely determined not to fail as a wife. I was going to have the prettiest house, the best behaved children. I would be beautifully turned out at all times, a perfect person and wife for this man. Such great expectations, and so much for another of my game plans. Because as George became more involved with his activities at the Elks and the Moose Club, and he began to enjoy his weekend retreats at various motels, I began a frenzied round of work in the PTA, the utility club, the garden club, whatever, church work. And I remember one day distinctly when I was directing a play over at our local school, and I was sort of the unpaid teacher over there. They liked to get my bad children so they could get the sucker. And I was screaming at everybody in the house to help me move all these props. And one of the children was hiding, and I tore into him, and I said, "Don't you see what I'm doing for you? You get up here and come help me." And he said, "But Mother, we'd like rather you just stay home." But I thought that it was necessary for me to compensate for all the things that I didn't like behind our closed doors. I became a nag and a shrew, but I really think that George had a more descriptive word. As the years progressed, George lost control more and more because that's the nature of the illness with which he was grappling. And I started to call my daddy and sit Wally Butts on him, and that would help a little bit for a while. It would get his attention. I began to dread parties. I dreaded all holidays. I heard an Al-Anon speaker say one time that she began dreading Christmas in January, and I could identify. You have to get braced in January for the next Christmas. Now, we would go to parties, and George and everybody there would be having a great time, and there over in the corner sat Priscilla Prune, passing judgment on all the people at the party, looking as though I was sniffing Limburger cheese. For a long time, I felt that it was my job to control him. And I thought that I had done a really good job because he was elected to a very top position in our church, and I thought it was because of me. I can see now that he may have had a few good qualities too. He very rarely showed up for meals, and so one night I decided to get brave and have lasagna, which was a dish that he avoided at all costs. But since the king of the palace was not expected, I whipped up this batch of lasagna, and the children and I were eating it, when who should grace us with his appearance but George? Well, I fixed him a plate, and I handed it to him, and he looked at that plate of food, and he walked over to this window and sailed that plate right out a two-story window in our backyard. Now, I did not say, "Precious darling, what can I fix that would whet your appetite," as you might expect. Keep in mind that this was my pre-Al-Anon period. So I turned with six flabbergasted little faces staring in my direction. I grabbed that red checkered cloth, all that lasagna, the tea, the salad. I bundled it all up and threw the whole kit and caboodle out in the backyard. And I said, "Why in the hell didn't you tell me you wanted to have dinner in the garden?" Oh, me. Along about this time, George would have a few drinks, and he'd put on his shorts, and he'd say, "Oh, no, my legs are withering up." And now that made me very nervous, too. And then he'd say, "I'm just going to get out of here as far away from you as I can get, and I'm going to California." And I never have figured out why he would prefer withering up in California to Georgia. But with six children in our home, we had a lot of other adjustments, learning disabilities and social adjustments. And somewhere in all this hoopla, I just lost Nancy. What on earth had happened to Nancy? Where was any sign of wit? Who was this person with this warped personality yelling at my children and crying at the drop of a hat? What on earth had happened? Back in 1973, George checked into a hospital for depression and for tests. He did this a lot. And I can just imagine how puzzled the hospital staff was when he was admitted by the local OBGYN, who was his favorite drinking partner at the time. So on this particular weekend, while George was drying out on the maternity floor, I was sitting at home feeling sorry for myself when this friend, I say friend, she was sort of like a missionary type person because I didn't have any friends, called and asked me if I would go with her to a lay witness renewal at a little church there. Now, I grew up in Athens in the First Methodist Church, and I didn't know anything about anything called a lay witness renewal, I'll be honest. I'm sure some of them did, but I didn't. I mostly went to church growing up to wear my new Easter hat and to look at the boys in the balcony on the opposite side of the church. But I did go with this lady, and I heard all these people stand up and say what an impact God had had on their lives. And I was absolutely desperate. I was like a child with their nose pressed to the candy store window. And I knew that whatever they had, I didn't have, and I needed it. And when that weekend was nearly over, a very wise man stood up and said, "If anybody wants what they have, walk down this aisle." Well, you know, some of these people had made a scene, and people in my family and with my wonderful background, we don't make scenes in church, you know. But, you know, I stumbled down that aisle, and I made a terrible scene. And I'm so grateful that I did, because without my knowing it, in that moment, a very great God came to live inside this party girl and this whipped wife. And I was the first miracle, I think, of many in my family. You know, if you are complacent and comfortable, you will not make changes. But if you hurt enough, just try putting your hand on a hot stove. You will get the lead out of your feet in a hurry. In our program, we have a book called The Courage to Change. And if you are needing the courage to change, call on your higher power right this very minute, and I promise you he will supply the courage. With his help, you'll be able to clean up your act and make the necessary changes. If you don't believe it, just look at me. I've changed from the ugly duckling to this beautiful swan that you see before. I'm just kidding. I walked an aisle with pleasure. She chatted all the way but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. Ah, but I walked an hour with sorrow, and not a word said she. But oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. George still had an upward battle with booze ahead, and I grew more desperate by the day. I didn't see any changes in my life, and I asked God to send me a friend. And I have a son named Wally, and he would go over and play with a boy named Hugh Hall. And he was the son of a doctor, and now Hugh is my doctor. And he noticed that this was a jolly, happy lady. And he said, "Miss Hall, my mother doesn't have any friends. And she cries all the time. And, you know, George is in there doing this, that, and the other." And said, "Would you be her friend?" I never did know for years why Liz Ann started calling me and inviting me to wonderful places. The first place that she took me was to a weekend retreat called Faith at Work. And the beautiful part about that, before I'd ever heard of this program or anything, this program was begun by Sam Shoemaker, who wrote Our 12 Steps. He looked around and saw how wonderful the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, and he wanted something like that for all people. I don't think that it's in existence anymore, but it certainly served its purpose at that time. Now, when we got home, we formed a study group, and we would get together, five of us, and study every week. And one day I spilled the beans, and I told them, as if they didn't know all that was happening in our home. And they began to join me in praying Bold George. And we zapped him good, let me tell you. Now, we didn't tell him, because he wouldn't have liked that one bit, but we prayed for him. And then they arranged for me to meet a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous, Lib. Many of you would know her because she was a counselor at Peachwood for a very long time. And we spent the afternoon together. And, you know, I admitted to Lib, to God, to myself, and anybody else who would listen all afternoon the exact nature of George Murray's wrongs. And I was entirely ready to have God extract them without benefit of Novocaine. And when I got through with that long saga, she said, "Poor fella." And that wasn't what I expected. But you know, it did make me look at it from another perspective. She sent me to Al-Anon. It didn't do a lot of good at first, but the literature was helpful. 2 years passed. I was going to Al-Anon. Our situation grew worse and worse. And as I began to crack at the seams, some of my friends said, "Let's go up to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, for the weekend." And I was really afraid to leave the children there, but I was just at the end. And so George promised that he'd take care of everything. And I called home on Friday night, and everything was great. And he said, "I told you I'd take care of all these children." When I called home Saturday night, everybody was crying because he was riding on their go-kart all over our street, visiting all the neighbors. And they were embarrassed. This is the first time that I ever remember getting on my knees. I'm in that motel room, and I said, "Lord, this is it. I have done absolutely all that I know to do. I don't know what else to do." Initially, I would say, I'm going to leave if you don't stop this. And he'd say, "Oh, it won't happen again. I promise, just stick it out." And then I'd say, "George, I mean it. I'm going if you don't stop this." And he'd say, I wish you'd shut up. And then a little later in the progression, I'd say, I'm going if you don't leave. And he'd say, I'll help you pack. So I was a little nervous about saying that. But that day, I began to pray. And I prayed for George, for my children, for myself, that God would look after me, because I was quite sure I would be divorced again. And I didn't know what to do about all these six children. But mostly, my prayer was for George. You know, I had kept saying for so long, God, why don't you change him so that I can love him? And the God of my understanding was saying, Nancy, why don't you love him so that I can change him? I came home from that weekend. I mentioned AA to him, and would you believe, I was flabbergasted he went. And he got meaner and meaner and meaner. I could always tell when he was about to have a big weekend, because he would be sort of a walking war for days ahead of time, sort of picking a fight at me. And when once he would get that expected rise from me, then of course he had to go drink, because anybody who lived with the wild woman of Borneo needs to have a drink, right? And so finally, in a total snit, he took a little trip to Chicago, and it took us 4 days in which to find him there. And it was very evident that he needed to go into treatment. We made arrangements for him to go to Peachford. This was before it was Charter Peachford at that time. As we were driving 90 miles an hour around the perimeter after picking him up on the plane, he began to be very anxious about this treatment for which he was asking, because recently we had been to see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And he was a little dubious about this. He thought maybe he was on the way to have a frontal lobotomy. I thought maybe a bonk on the head with a sledgehammer would be a lot cheaper and get it over with in a hurry. That particular day was Mother's Day, May 9th, 1976. I had no cards, no gifts, but little did I know it, that was to be the greatest Mother's Day gift I was ever to receive, his affiliation with Alcoholics Anonymous. The ride home from Peachwood was the saddest of my life, because he made it very clear that he planned to get a divorce. Then I had to face everybody in Griffin. I had to go to the grocery store. I had to go in the, I'm scared of bankers, and I had to go make arrangements for this money for him to stay there. I've never had to do that kind of thing. And all those nosy neighbors, you know. Ugh. And then, too, I began to be afraid to go out of the door. And one day I realized, though, that no matter who I had faced or what I was going through, that this very great God had not let me go one place that he didn't go with me. He's promised me he would never leave me nor forsake me. And that has turned out to be the truth. Lots of times I go off on my own without him, you know. I want to hide from him. But once I start my steps working again and begin walking with him, he picks right up. 4 days into George's Peachford stay, he ignored his roommate who had been watching television for 3 days without benefit of a set. And he got on his knees there and turned his life and his will over to the care of God. And he too became a miracle. He said that it felt as though warm things were going all through him, and as though the curtains were billowing in a gentle, tight breeze. And he also was quite clear that he was in the presence of God. The first time that I saw him there, I knew that he was different. It was at Peachford that George was really introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, which was to become a part of the very fiber of our lives. Over the years, we were to know our share of challenges, financial challenges and then a comeback financially, health problems, both his and mine. But somehow we always helped each other as we ran the obstacle course. Certainly there were rough spots in the road. Betty P. is here, and she knows. I have to tell the truth. But we seemed to sort of bump over them together as a team. I laced up his shoes when rheumatoid arthritis robbed him of the ability to do so. Here was a man who had played football on a scholarship at Clemson University, who had been state double and singles tennis champion, was a fine golfer, and was also boxing champion of the Pacific Fleet in World War II, and he was unable to tie his shoelaces. From you, he had honed his skills in accepting his life as it is, rather than as we wish that it could be. With amazing serenity, he accepted each and every setback. In other words, he accepted that which he could not change. Once a beloved doctor friend said to him, Liz Ann's husband, as a matter of fact, George, don't you ever wish that you could take a drink, what with all the pain you've endured? And he thought for a minute, and he said, you know, I've honestly never thought of it one time. Apparently the desire to take a drink was taken away from me forever. He stood by me, and he comforted me when I suffered a heart attack 12 years ago. He was a source of strength, and I was able to lean on him thanks to his association with AA. Now, the other day I heard some ladies in the grocery store fussing about how their husbands snore and keep them awake. And I remembered how George used to snore, and he wore hearing aids, and when he would take them off at night and turn over, he was in a lot of pain, so he would moan a lot and just make a lot of racket. And I learned in Al-Anon that if I'm unable to change my circumstances, it is imperative that I change my attitude. And so one night when he was making all that noise, I began to pray, God, thank you for that snoring and that noise, because it means that he's here and he's all right. From that time on, those sound effects never bothered me one whit. I slept like a baby. Today, the greatest challenge that I face is the acceptance of the silence in the middle of the night. For at the end of June a year ago, on a Friday night, George and I were having dinner in a restaurant in Griffin, and as we were eating our salads, he said, you know, it's great that the children are out of the nest, it's just as it should be, but golly, wouldn't we be lonely without each other here? And boy, did I agree emphatically. Within 2 hours after he collapsed in that restaurant, only one of us was still working a program. Apparently, 2 weeks prior to his death, I'm sorry, this is the first time I've done this. George had had a premonition of some sort. Because we found a paper in his desk, neatly typed, a list of all the music, the scriptures, the pallbearers that he wanted at his funeral. And in an accompanying letter, he stated that his main goal in life was to see that I be taken care of after he was gone. Such amazing love, more than I ever could have deserved. As we were leaving for his funeral, I told my sisters not to expect a crowd because we had been out of circulation for so long due to his illness and that of my mom's. But then what do I know? Because as we turned the corner to the largest church in Griffin, there were cars as far as you could see. And they stood outside and against the balcony and against the walls. And together we celebrated the life of this extraordinary man, whose greatest weakness, as some might label alcoholism, but which we know of as a disease, this man whose pain became his major strength, this remarkable member of Alcoholics Anonymous who touched and made a difference in the lives of all who crossed his path. He helped start Midway Recovery there in Griffin, and I ask that donations be made in his name there rather than flowers. They received over almost $5,000, I think. As for me, I can honestly say that I truly kept my promise and I did love him come rain or come shine. And yes, it has been lonely. There have been many sad moments this past year, but I cling to the concept, as does Hank, of today. I know that I'm still alive and I must live today and each day as it comes. This is the day the Lord hath made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Because of my misfix-it nature, one which many of us in Al-Anon share, I think, it's hard for me not to rush around willy-nilly and try to fix the pain of widowhood which I have experienced. Things out of sync, it seems to be my natural bent to take matters in hand and try to set them right. And usually that just results in complications left and right. how much better to let go and let God. So I try very hard to shake off thoughts of a new game plan which tries to formulate in my overactive little mind, a game plan in which some enchanted evening across the crowded room, even at my advanced age, I'll see a stranger and once again the earth will move under my feet. I try very hard, sometimes successfully, sometimes without, to envision what he might be like, and to wonder if God has anyone out there for me. I might as well tell you that legs don't matter to me anymore. especially since mine was shot. And looks not too much either, although I'd rather his favorite holiday not be Halloween. But to tell you the truth, what interests me and other people most is a strong spiritual program, preferably one centered around the 12 steps. And I might like somebody who doesn't cringe when they hear Go Dawgs. Maybe a sense of humor, a love for dancing, somebody who likes to eat out, doesn't like too many homemade biscuits. But you see, there I go again with all my pipe dreams, and you all know by now what happens to my game plans. Today is my precious gift from God, and as I wind this down, I'll fill you in on the tight days I'm experiencing lately. I teach Sunday school once a month. Four of the ladies in my class are here. They also happen to be Al-Anons, but they're here with me. I'm going to ask everybody from the Bonanza group and the Griffin groups to stand up and show you what kind of wonderful friends I have. Would y'all stand up a minute? These are all... And also, my niece, Kristen, and her husband, Barry, are here, y'all. And I love to go to the movies. I even went to a health spa with my daughter-in-law this summer. Now, that was a trip. And my brother-in-law said to tell all single men of advanced age that if you notice that I'm losing any weight, be very cautious because, as he puts it, they're always lean when they're hunting. I have dated a little bit, but, we don't have long enough to tell you, and besides, you sort of think it was Tales from the Crypt. On Monday nights, I go to Country Line dancing classes. 3 mornings and 2 afternoons a week, I go to aerobics with my only two daughters-in-law. My plans include joining the Atlanta Shag Club, if I can get up the nerve to go. I have an old log house at Lake Oconee. We like to go over there for some weekends. And incidentally, thinking about that Shag Club, you know, I went to Miss Flossie Jurdine's ballroom dancing class when I was a little girl, and the one thing that I determined when I was 12 years old that I did not want to be was a wallflower. So I've already extracted a promise from Hardy that he'll dance with me tonight, and some of you ladies let me borrow your husband's one dance. So I don't want to go to that dance and watch everybody have a good time. I'll have a major resentment. I'm a grandmother 4 times over. Lately, I've had to reemphasize the importance of my Al-Anon program as another person very, very close to me begins to question and try to live with and grapple with alcoholism. I need you more than ever so that I can keep my mouth shut. Maybe I'll travel, but football season looms on the horizon September 2nd, and the chapel bells in Athens are ringing for me. I want to say emphatically before I step down that I'm very grateful to have married an alcoholic. Otherwise, how else could I have found the tools with which to tackle my own character defects, to achieve the degree of peace that I now enjoy, to continue my quest to become a mature, unselfish, other-centered individual. It was not a tragedy, after all, for George Murray to be an alcoholic. The great theologian C.H. Spurgeon said that if you navigate only little streams and creeks, you will never know the God of storms. George knew a great deal about the God of storms. So did I, because together we battled some storms of hurricane proportion. I'm grateful that I have been able to become better acquainted with this God who stands with us in the storms. because I was able to see him more clearly in George and in so many of you in this room. He drew a circle that shut me out. Heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took him in. Alcohol drew a circle around George. It threatened to shut me out, my children, and all the good things that he was. But with the help of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous, we led him to you. You drew the circle that took him in. So how could I do anything other than love you? George's marker now bears the words of Psalms 84:11. It was with this scripture that he ended almost every AA talk he ever made. And I'll leave you with this beautiful thought. The Lord God is a sun and a shield. He will give you grace and glory. Not one good thing will he withhold from them who walk uprightly. Thank you.